Hi, this is Allison Sheridan of the NoCillaCast podcast, hosted at podfeet.com, a technology geek podcast with an ever-so-slight Macintosh bias. Today is Sunday, June 14th, 2015, and this is show number 527. Well, before I forget, next week's show will be delayed by a couple of days because I'm going to be at the Midwest Mac Barbecue and Mac Stock with Steve for the weekend. For the live show listeners, I'm going to do the live show at noon Pacific time on Tuesday, the 23rd of June. Now, I realize that messes up Alistair out in New Zealand and Rose in Australia, but it means that Tracy Bosells can make it because they're out in Europe, and Europe is asleep by the time I start the show. So for once, Europe is going to get to be able to listen to the show. Since I was moving the show from its normal day anyway, I figured it'd be a great day to do this for Tracy. So if you've never been to the live show before, because it's in the middle of the night for you, I'm pretty sure this makes it like 8 p.m. for England, Ireland kind of time zones, and then 9 p.m. for Germany and other people in that time zone. You can find all of the instructions on how to participate over at podfeet.com/live. You can watch the video there. You can check out chat clients. You can chat right there if you don't want a chat client of your own. And you can even watch the clock on that page to make sure you've done the math right. It shows the time at my house, so if it's coming up on 12 p.m. on Tuesday, then you know you did it right. By the way, if you use the new NoCillaCast app, you'll get notifications from it telling you when the next live show is. Alternatively, over on podfeet.com/live, there's also a calendar link that you can copy and then paste into your calendar tool of choice to subscribe to it. I keep that up to date whenever I'm changing the show time. I hope to see more new people there and some of the more classically trained NoCillaCastaways as well. I'm super excited about the show this week for a couple of reasons, a bunch of reasons, actually. I've got a review from Chris from Michigan, who, by the way, we get to meet at MacStock and the Midwest Mac Barbecue in Chicago this week. And actually, let's see, we got a couple people in the chat room right now who are going to be there. Looks like Brett is going to be there and Lewis. So we're getting really, really excited about that. Anyway, so Chris from Michigan has a review for us. And then we have a review by Steve about this really cool GoPro gimbal that he got. Then I'm going to tell you about my hot water recirculation pump, which is actually really, really cool. And then on Chit Chat Across the Pond, I got to talk to Patrick Beja from French Spin and the Daily Tech News Show. He was dying to talk about WWDC, and we had a blast talking. He was fantastic, and I guarantee you're going to enjoy that. Well, speaking of Daily Tech News Show, this week Tom Merritt was away on special assignment, so he left his show in the capable hands of his three co-hosts and his two producers, but that still left him with one day where he needed a host, and in a moment of madness, he actually picked me. I was thrilled to get to do it, but when the time came, I was actually kind of terrified. It's different when it's someone else's baby, you know? Like when you drive your own car or ride your own bike, it doesn't bother you at all, but if it's somebody else's, it's kind of a lot of responsibility. I don't think I screwed it up too much. The show aired on Tuesday, and my guest was Todd Whitehead of Alpha Geek Radio fame. Alpha Geek Radio listeners, yay! It was Todd Whitehead. Anyway, I posted the video over at podfeet.com so you can watch, or you can go subscribe to it at dailytechnewsshow.com. Like I said in the outline there at the beginning, Chris from Michigan is here to tell us about a sunrise-sunset calendar called Rise. Now, don't be confused by the name. I was at first. This is not the application also known as Sunrise. That's a calendar app that Microsoft just bought. This one is called Rise, and it's a horse of a completely different color.
Hey, Allison and fellow castaways. Chris from Michigan here, and I've got an iPhone app that does just one thing and does it well. It is called Rise, the Sunrise Sunset Calendar by Sunrise Sunset Calendar, LLC. Here's a problem to be solved. I'm planning a trip to California, and I will need to catch a bus at Powell and Market in San Francisco at 7 a.m. to connect to an Amtrak train in Oakland. I'm staying in an Airbnb 1.5 miles away, and I'm planning to walk to the bus stop. But will I be walking in the dark, or will natural light be guiding my way? This free app gives sunrise and sunset information for your location and date, or any other location and any future date. As an added touch, it also gives a first light and last light time as well, which, in my problem, will be more helpful than just sunrise and sunset. You swipe to the right to set a location. Swipe to the left to set a date. Swipe up and down for the sunrise and sunset times, as well as the first light and last light times. There are a couple of in-app purchases, one for notifications, $1.99, and one for weather and notifications, $2.99. But I have several weather apps, and I don't need to be notified when the sun comes up, so the in-app purchases are not that vital. Rise, the sunrise sunset calendar, is optimized for the iPhone, but still looks pretty good on an iPad and is available in the App Store. That's it for now. I use the Twitter handle CalMickey, and I will stay subscribed. And by the way, Allison, at 68 degrees, it is warmer here in West Michigan than it was our entire 11-day stay in Northern and Southern California just last month.
All right. Well, that sounds really cool, Chris. I think that's a neat application. I am thrilled to know that you're going to be at Mac Stock in the Midwest Mac Barbecue, too. One of the common misconceptions about California is that it's hot here, but it isn't hot. It just isn't cold. There are hot parts, I mean, inland Orange County and the Pomona area east of Los Angeles, and of course the desert itself gets really hot, but if you're by the ocean, it's quite mild. The real surprise to those of us from Michigan, I'm from Michigan too, is how cold it gets at night. I remember as a young nerdlet of 7 years old in Michigan running around at 8 at night during the summer in shorts and a t-shirt and being quite warm, but out here you actually have to put on a sweater for most evenings. It's pretty much 70 during the day all year long and 55 degrees at night, so go figure.
Hi, Allison. This is husband Steve back with another product review. The gadget I'm reviewing today is the G4 handheld steady gimbal made by FiuTech. That's spelled F-E-I-Y-U. This cool piece of kit is designed to steady a GoPro Hero camera while taking handheld video. Let's start with the problem to be solved. Let's say you're on a vacation and decide to take some video with your GoPro camera while in a Jeep bouncing wildly over the dunes, or riding a camel in the Dubai desert, or possibly riding on the back of a lumbering elephant. You bring back your video for editing, and it looks pretty good, but you notice how shaky the video is due to all of that bouncing around you did. You try to stabilize the scenes with your video editor, but most of the scenes are just too shaky to be properly stabilized with software. Enter the G4 handheld steady gimbal. This device does a wonderful job of stabilizing your GoPro camera under almost any moving, rotating, vibrating, or shaking conditions. The G4 gimbal performs much better than those handheld Steadicam rigs with counterbalance weights hanging underneath. It doesn't need any balancing prior to use, and it maintains a very steady lock in azimuth, pitch, and roll, regardless of how vigorously you move it. In Allison's show notes, I've included a side-by-side GoPro video comparison of Tesla, our dog, running down the sidewalk, taken with and without the G4 gimbal to show how effective it is in stabilizing video. I first heard about this nifty device while Allison and I were vacationing in India with Don McAllister and friends. Don had just purchased the G3 version of this gimbal and used it for several scenes he shot there. He let me try it out, and I was hooked from the outset. The G4 is the next generation beyond Don's G3 version, but they are nearly identical except for a few features that I'll mention later. The G4 is a three-axis handheld gimbal that you slip your GoPro Hero camera into, push a button to activate the gimbals, wait about 2 seconds for the gimbals to stabilize, and begin taking smooth, professional-looking video regardless of your movement. It's pretty clear that Feiyu took advantage of recent advancements in gimbal technology used for lightweight quadcopters and other drones to design this compact handheld device. The gimbal is solidly built with aircraft-grade black anodized aluminum. Weighing in at only 265 grams, just over a half pound, it's light enough to hold with one hand for extended periods. The G4 is made up of a simple camera mounting frame attached to a three-axis gimbal that is mounted to a 5.5-inch cylindrical grip. It feels good in the hand, and it's easy to manipulate and aim your GoPro in any orientation. The unit is powered by two specialized 900 milliamp batteries contained in the gimbal's grip that provide about 5 hours of operation. The G4 comes with a two-piece carbon fiber extension for an additional 29 inches of handle, 4 batteries, and a USB charger. Feiyu made attaching and detaching your GoPro camera to the gimbal very quick and easy. No tools are needed. Just unscrew two thumb screws to open up the camera frame, slide in your GoPro, and hand-tighten the two thumb screws to lock in your camera. One downside here is that the camera frame is not made to handle a GoPro in its housing. Instead, it's designed to hold a naked GoPro that is without a housing. Since the GoPro housing is generally used to protect the camera from moisture, a GoPro mounted in this gimbal should not be used in wet conditions, which kind of makes sense since the gimbal itself is also not waterproof. The G4 gimbal's camera mount is designed to attach only to GoPro Hero cameras and not to any other cameras. It would have been nice if the gimbal had additional mounting brackets that supported other small cameras, such as an iPhone. For additional cost, an accessory cable is also available that allows you to charge your GoPro while it's in use in the gimbal. This comes in handy since GoPro batteries don't last very long while taking video. The charging feature is not available, however, on the G3 version of the gimbal. Both the G3 and G4 have three modes of operation. First, the heading following mode, which allows smooth rotation in azimuth or heading for pointing the camera while pitch and roll are stabilized. Second, the heading and pitch following mode, which supports smooth rotation in heading and in pitch for pointing the camera while only roll is stabilized. Third, locking mode, which maintains a constant and stable azimuth, pitch, and roll in the direction the camera is pointed when the gimbal is activated. There's a special fourth inversion mode available in the G4 only, which allows the gimbal to be inverted for cases where you want to capture video below you or low to the ground. In this mode, the G4 operates in the heading following mode, but upside down. Okay, let's talk about cost. The G4 handheld gimbal, as I've described it, sells for about $300 US on Amazon, plus another $30 for the extension poles, and $17 for the GoPro charging cable. If you want to save a little money and are willing to give up a few features, you can get the G3 model for about $245 US. All right, let's move on to the G4's pros and cons. On the pro side, it's a solid, ergonomic, lightweight design. GoPro attachment and detachment are quick and easy with no adjustments or balancing required. And the G4 stabilizes video scenes extremely well under most moving conditions with professional-looking results. On the con side, the G4 accommodates only the GoPro Hero camera. GoPro camera cannot be in a housing while mounted in the gimbal, so it's exposed to the environment. And the cost is on the high side, but the build is of high quality. My overall assessment is that the G4 is a great solution for those who are willing to pay a premium for well-stabilized and professional-looking GoPro video in dry conditions, while the G3 is better suited for those who want to save a little money. Both devices may be a bit pricey for many, but for those who have a GoPro camera and really care about recording stable video under moving or shaking conditions, the G3 or G4 handheld steady gimbals may just be what you're looking for. That's it for now, Allison.
Well, I think this thing is really, really cool. After watching Don play with it on our vacation, we were both hooked on the quality of the video that he got out of it. So it is really cool. There is one thing that irritates me. Steve mentioned that the cable that allows you to charge it to the version that Steve got was an extra $17. And that really irritated me because I bought him the better one because I watch him all the time when we're out and about. He's always having to charge his batteries. And I figured that'd be awesome if he had this whole hand grip full of batteries and it would charge the GoPro and keep it powered. And then we get it and he's like, well, but it didn't come with the cable. It's like, come on, why would you not get it? It's a little tiny cable. It's got a little, plus $17. That's ridiculous. But other than that, I think this thing is really, really cool. And I'm looking forward to some fantastic video from Steve. I should mention that, Steve, you haven't done a lot of editing of that video you took in India yet, have you? I don't think I've actually seen any from India yet. But anyway. All right, I named the NoCellacast with a weird name so that you could never tell me that I'm off topic. It's not really good for SEO search, let me tell you that. But if I'm off topic, you can't tell, right? That is going to come in very handy this week when I tell you about our new hot water recirculation pump and how we use our Craftsman infrared thermometer to test the results. Well, you might have heard that California is having a wee bit of a drought while many other places in the world are suffering with record rainfall. I think Stephen Getz told me that they've been asked to turn the water on and let it run because they had too much water. We should be able to figure that out. But until we figure out a way to level things out across the globe, which if we did figure it out, that would probably cause some completely other natural disaster, so I hope we don't figure it out, we in California are looking for ways to save water. At my house, one of the things that drives me bonkers and has for, I don't know, how long have we been in this house? Since 1990. Is that 15 years? 25 years. Anyway, one of the things that drives me bonkers is how long it takes for water in our bathroom and kitchen to get hot. I hate seeing all that precious water literally go down the drain every single day. My brother Grant is really smart about all this environmental stuff, and he's, like I said, very environmentally conscious. So I called him and I said, hey, find me an easy, inexpensive solution to this that does not include me carrying buckets of water down the stairs to wash my clothes or something. Not going to do it. Well, he'd heard about ways to circulate water around your entire plumbing system in your house, and Steve had heard about those too. That would involve basically replumbing most of the house. So that didn't meet my requirements of easy and cheap. So he said, I don't know the answer to your question. He always says he doesn't know, or he always says it can't be done first. An hour later, he called me back and told me he thought he'd found the solution. He found these things called hot water hot water recirculation pumps. It sounds like the same thing I just described, but it's a very clever solution that does not require replumbing the house. There are two parts to the solution. There's the pump itself, and that gets connected to the hot water output of your water heater. And there's a very small passive valve that you put under the farthest sink from the water heater. That little valve is the clever bit. The valve goes between the hot and cold lines of your sink, and it has a thermostat in it that measures the temperature of the water on the hot side. Let's say you set the preferred starting temperature at 90 degrees Fahrenheit. When the temperature goes below 90, when the thermostat finds that, it opens the valve up, allowing hot water to be pushed by the pump from the hot side to the cold side. This is how it's different from a full circulation system, which requires a loop on the hot water line. The pump will now push hot water towards your sink through the valve until the temperature is back up to 90 degrees, at which point the valve will close itself. There's one downside to this, and it's that your cold water is sort of lukewarm now. But in our house, we don't ask for cold water nearly as often as we want hot water, and cold comes from the source pretty quickly anyway. The only one who really cares is our cat, Buzzy. The good news is that we had two engineers involved in this project, so you know we're going to get some good metrics, right? How else would you know if the solution really did the trick? The pump Steve bought is the Watts 500-800 Premier Hot Water Recirculation Pump for $200 on Amazon. Amazon affiliate link, even for a water pump. I love it. The good news is for us is that we are buying a new hot water heater anyway, and David from Stefan's Plumbing agreed to install the pump for free. One caveat is that the pump does require power, so if you don't have power in your hot water closet, you're going to need to make that happen too. Steve installed the valve under the sink by himself. Now, I don't mean to diminish Steve's plumbing skills at all, but this must have been a really easy job because it only took him about 20 minutes and he made zero trips to the hardware store. I actually kind of wondered if he did it right because we have a rule that you can't do any plumbing unless you go at least 3 times. We measured the time it took the water in the sink to go from its ambient temperature to 100 degrees Fahrenheit before and after the pump and valve were installed. We did the same test in the shower. But of course, we had to have a cool gadget to measure the temperature, right? So Steve used his handy-dandy Craftsman infrared thermometer, $40 on Amazon. By the way, there's an Amazon affiliate link for that, too. This thing is so much fun to play with. You shoot a laser at the water, and the digital readout tells you the temperature. So let's go through the metrics that we collected on this. The sink started at 72F before we had the pump and valve installed, but started at 92F after the pump and valve installation, so we had nice warm water to start with. Before we put the pump in place, it took 54 seconds to heat up to 100 and only 22 seconds afterwards. That was a 32-second difference, which was a 60% drop in wasted water. That's pretty huge. The shower was almost as impressive. It went from 1 minute and 8 seconds beforehand to only 36 seconds afterward. Now, that was, again, oddly, a 32-second drop, but in this case, a 47% drop in wasted water. We can absolutely cause this a huge success from an annoying perspective. I can't be waiting around that extra 32 seconds. I don't have that kind of time. But how much water are we saving? That required us to measure how much water was wasted in those 32 seconds before the pump and how often we heat the water up in a normal week. Now, I'm afraid we didn't have a sophisticated laser method to measure the flow. Instead, we used a bucket and a stopwatch. We did use the stopwatch at my Apple Watch, so it was pretty high tech. We measured how long it took to fill a gallon in the bucket from the shower and how long it took for a quart in the sink. Then we approximated how often we do this in the bathroom and the kitchen sink, where it used to be equally bad. Oh, I almost forgot to mention that fixing the upstairs farthest sink from the water heater also fixed the kitchen sink. That's important. If you find another sink in your house that isn't heating up quickly enough, you only need to buy and install another valve for that sink. You don't need a second pump. You just have the same pump. You just put another one of those valves in place, which is far cheaper. All right, are you ready for the bottom line? For the cost of a $200 pump and valve combo, plus whatever your cost of insulation was, definitely under $100, we will save 2,863 gallons of water a year. Now, you might be worried that we're constantly running a pump and now wasting electricity instead, but the pump comes with a timer that lets you specify what times you want that instant gratification of hot water. I would call this a success on every front, and it kills me to have to give credit to my brother Grant for this. I want to play you a very short clip of something Dave Hamilton said on the Mac Geek Gab recently. Take a listen.
Allison Sheridan at podfeet.com, of course, host of the Nozilla cast. She put together a killer tutorial on the on how to create and set up secure email for your Mac and also for iOS.
All right. I have been telling you guys about Clarify for making tutorials for a really long time. If you didn't believe me, do you believe Dave Hamilton? I mean, it's Dave Hamilton of the Mac Geek Gab saying that my tutorial was killer. That was, of course, done with Clarify. All of the tutorials you see over at podfeet.com and left-hand sidebar, I got tutorials about everything. They're all written with Clarify. So if you want to look as smart as me and be able to make killer tutorials, just document stuff you know with Clarify from clarify-it.com. They got a free trial, 14 days, I think. It's got they got a Mac version, they got a Windows version, they got a sliders version. They got everything for you. You got to go give that thing a try, and then be sure to tell them that I sent you. So again, head on over to clarify-it.com. Well, it's that time of the week again. It's time for Chit Chat Across the Pond, and I'm really excited to invite Patrick Beja of FrenchSpin.com on the show for the very first time. How are you doing today, Patrick?
I'm doing most excellent. I'm very glad that you're giving me an opportunity to finally let loose and talk about everything I want to talk about on WWDC.
Yeah, I heard Patrick on the Daily Tech News show. He was all sad because they'd already mashed it out for a day or two on Daily Tech News show. And he was like, oh, man, I don't get to talk about it. And then I was on it. And I didn't get to talk about it. So we should talk about it. And man, this is wide open. There's an awful lot of stuff happened at WWDC. What really excited you?
So I think the thing that I was the most happy about, there's a bunch of stuff that didn't really, you know, I think El Capitan, the name is the most exciting thing in the entire presentation.
I don't hate it. I don't hate it at all.
No, it's fun. It's fun. And there are a few things here and there, but definitely for me, the coolest thing is what they're doing for the iPad.
Ah.
Yeah, it's, you know, two features that I'm really looking forward to using are the actual multitasking, which is something that I think the Windows users, the Windows tablet users are going to be laughing at us for finally getting on our iPads. Mm-hmm. But it's really something that I think is going to do wonders for productivity on the device. And
you're talking about the side-by-side thing, right?
Right. So the slide over function, which is where you slide over it, basically what is essentially an iPhone app that is longer to fit the size of the iPad on the side of your actual app you're already using, is going to be useful here and there for some things. But the split view, which allows you to have two apps running side by side, half of the screen or, you know, two-thirds, one-third, and have them fully functional iPad apps, is going to be very helpful for me. And the other thing that works almost, you know, it's the same category of feature, meaning productivity, is the improvements they're doing to the keyboard, to the keyboard.
Let's wait till the keyboard, because I want to ask you a question. I don't understand why they said in the keynote that the two side-by-side applications, a split screen, that was only going to work on the iPad Air 2, right?
Yeah.
But then they said this slide over thing was going to work on the other versions of the iPad. So I don't really get what the slide over is. It sounds like it's just a task switcher if it's not actually running the application over there.
I think it is. I think it is running the application, but it's running essentially a less demanding kind of iPhone version of the app. And I'm not sure you can use the slide over app at the same time as you can use the... I think you sort of switch to the other one as you're leaving it, the main one in the background, and you can't use both at the same time.
So maybe it's more like glances on the watch, or like you can see that you got a tweet, but you can't do anything about it? You can bring it over and say, oh, I read that tweet, okay, I don't care, and swipe it back?
Maybe something like that. That's what it looks like. Okay. It definitely doesn't seem like you can use both exactly at the same time, because needing the iPad Air is probably about RAM, and the iPad Air has more RAM than any other previous iPads, and I'm guessing that's the reason it can run the two full iPad applications at the same time. It might be that you can use with the slide over, it's a fully functional app, except it's just the iPhone version of the app.
But and so if it were RAM much. Limited, how come on the lower versions of the iPad, you're going to be able to run a video playing real time while you're doing something else?
Oh, that's not very RAM demanding.
Really?
The video is going to be streaming. No, it's a lot easier.
It's not processor power limited then.
Even that, nowadays all the videos are H.264 and all of that is hardware decoded, so it uses very little power.
Okay.
I really don't think that's a big deal having
okay.
the video in
there. Okay.
It's very useful. But,
yeah. No, I didn't hate the keyboard stuff until they told me there was a better way to do it. Now I hate the way it is right now.
Well, I've hated it for a long time. The most annoying thing is basically, cursor placement, it's atrocious on any device. It's fine if you want to, write a couple of words, but if you want to write a little bit more text, the fact that you don't have the arrows on your keyboard to move the cursor around, it makes it really painful to go and edit some word that you mistyped or to add a little bit here and there in the text. And with this thing, I don't know if you want us to describe the features we're talking about.
Yeah, we probably should, because I don't – and I'll tell you why. Each time I go back and I look at a little bit of the keynote, I think, oh, I never heard him say that. So everybody's missing a lot of it because there are so many little tiny details.
So that trackpad thing is really clever. It's not just the trackpad, by the way. They are also adding copy-paste – buttons, dedicated buttons on the keyboard. So that's going to be kind of useful. And so the way it works, that trackpad, is that you have your keyboard on the glass of the device. And when you put down two fingers on that keyboard, it transforms into, it basically just changes, removes the keys, and it transforms into a trackpad. Hmm. And when you move your fingers around on the pad, you move the cursor. And this allows you to have very precise, very quick placement of the cursor, and it works as well for selection and changing the selection and all of this. And the funny thing is, by the way, that exact use, that exact functionality was showed up, I think, 3 or 4 years ago as a concept by some random person on the internet who designed it as a concept, and everyone thought it was a genius idea, and no one implemented it, at Apple or Google or anywhere. And now they're showing up, this feature, and it's exactly the same. Literally, it's the same. But anyway,
I like it.
Do
you think that's going to be a tough? I think that it's going to be discoverable easily, but I think a lot of people might get confused by what happened to my keyboard, who haven't watched the keynote.
No, I think it's going to be. It seems fairly straightforward, like the natural way this should work. It's. Obviously, we haven't put our hands on it, so I can't be sure. But it feels like something people are going to integrate fairly quickly.
Okay.
And between this and the multitasking, I think it's going to do wonders for the iPads, the productivity side of the iPads. I think people are going to be able to work a lot more with those devices now. Not as much as you would with a full-fledged computer, but, you know.
And sales, right? Because the really cool stuff is on the iPad Air, too.
And I think we're going to see an iPad Pro finally being announced in what is it? Maybe September, October.
That's the 12.9 inch that is rumored?
Yeah, exactly.
See, I thought the 12-inch MacBook was the new iPad Pro.
It is. It does look very much like it could be, indeed. But yeah, I think the iPad Pro, it might even have a stylus. But anyway, that's for another time. It's going to be something that takes full advantage of those features. But I'm very happy that I got an iPad Air 2 because I'm going to be able to use it. And
that explains your excitement. I have an iPad Air 1.
Yeah, there you go. Now,
I'm excited about the improvements in Siri because she just irritates the heck out of me. Actually, is your Siri a boy or a girl?
My Siri is the American girl Siri.
Okay. But yeah, that's interesting. Is there a French Siri?
There is. But I figured it's, so first of all, I listen to a lot of, you know, I have a lot of English language music, and I'm not sure she would understand it. If I don't know how it works, if I have the French Siri, do I have to pronounce the names of the bands with the French accent or... I think it would be weird. And also, I'm guessing, I'm not sure of this, but anecdotally, my friends have been telling me it's the case. The English version of Siri is the most, you know, the most advanced, the most reliable one.
Wow, so. That must be horrible in other languages then.
But then, you know, yeah, no, it's for me, it's okay. It's not perfect. But
I just get into fights with her all the time. My favorite one I have lately is I say, call Pat Dengler Mobile. And Siri comes back and says, I don't have a number for Pat Dengler Mobile. Would you like to call Pat Dengler Mobile? Yes. And then she does. So why are you arguing with me? That's what I said. It's like an argument you have with your spouse. Why don't you listen to me?
It is, yeah. It's. I mean, I think you're saying you're very excited about the new improvements to Siri. I don't think they're going to be... The predictive stuff could be cool. I don't think she's going to have a lot more... she's not going to be understanding what we tell her significantly better just yet.
Aww. Well, one of the things they said, a tiny detail I picked up the 11th time I listened to a little bit of the keynote, was that you're going to be able to, there's an API for search inside applications. So that could say, Siri, launch Downcast and place French Spin for me.
Yeah.
And
yeah,
that could work, which you can't do anything like that today.
I guess that could work, but I don't know. I think I don't really use Siri all that much today. I use dictation all the time. Siri, it doesn't, you know, every time I ask for something, she tells me that she's looking for it on the web and spits out a bunch of links, right?
Yeah. Well, but if she got better at that, maybe we would. Yeah, I don't use her very much at all. I mean, I tend to use her to find out how tall someone is. Stephen, I don't know why, but Stephen and I always said, like, yeah, or how old? Those are the two questions you get, and we're always wrong. But I like the idea of chained commands. Like, I remember asking her, when is the next Lakers game? And she said, Wednesday at 7:00. I said, who are they playing? And she said, what? Because she's like a goldfish, right? She doesn't remember what you just said. It's like, I just said that. And I'm hearing that that's going to be a piece of it. And I've really like to see that.
Yeah, it would be cool. I mean, Siri is chasing, in some respects, is chasing Google now, and predictive is part of that, trying to anticipate your needs and what you are going to ask for. I think ultimately it is going to become an essential part of the way we interact with our devices, these kinds of, virtual artificial intelligence
systems.
Human interfaces,
yeah.
The way we just interact with them. But I don't think we're there yet, and I don't think next year is the time that is going to finally become super useful all of a sudden. I think it's going to be iterative, and it's going to take years and years. But
well,
I might be wrong.
Sad.
You know, maybe maybe Siri 2016 is going to be the one.
I've been realizing that Siri gets more and more useful the smaller the device is. So I don't use Siri on my iPhone or my iPad, but I use it on my watch.
What do you do with it, though?
Well, actually, well, I'm mixing things up. I shouldn't say Siri. I should say dictation.
Right.
So
right,
I don't use it on my Mac, and I don't use it on my iPad. I use it some on my iPhone. I use it all the time on my watch since there is no keyboard. But it works incredibly well on the watch.
Well, it works the same way on the phone.
Oh,
like for dictation.
I don't think so. I get just piles and gobs of errors on the phone, and the watch seems to pick up virtually everything. I mean, it's very rare that it makes a mistake for me. Maybe I should try it more, though.
Maybe you're speaking in a different manner when you're talking to your watch. Maybe you know I don't know.
My new baby.
Silly, and you look, you know, kind of weird talking to your watch, so you're speaking less loudly, or I don't know.
That's interesting. Interesting. Well, what else in, let's see, we talked about the iPad. What else, let's see, what else was fun? Oh, what about all this stuff about the Notes app being, they said, like, everybody uses Notes?
You know, that's funny. I've heard many people say, oh, Notes is that one app that everyone puts into their crap I don't use folder. And why do they even care about the Notes app? I use it all the time. It's one of the apps, the Apple apps that I use the most. If you know, it's very useful to me, and the fact that it syncs with not only the Mac version of the app, but also on the web. So I also have a Windows machine at home. I can have the notes taken at any point, anywhere. It's very easy, and I know that some people will say, "Well, you could use whatever Evernote or." Some other apps, but there is value to the fact that this app, this one is just here, and it's simple and it's easy. And I think they're striking the right balance between having a little bit of improved formatting and that kind of thing, and still keeping it relatively simple. So I'm happy about those changes.
Interesting. I have used it from time to time when I'm just, I don't know, just on a lark I use it, but I've probably written 20 total notes. That's interesting. And it never occurred to me to go to iCloud.com. I just logged in. You're right. There it is. Huh.
Yeah.
Who knew?
Yeah. If you have a Mac, you have the Notes app on your Mac, but if you have a PC, it's basically all of the main uses that you have for your phone. The things that sync are going to be available on iCloud.com. That is something that I think might have gone a little bit underreported or under-discussed when they relaunched iCloud.com. It's the fact that it is essentially not just multi-platform, but platform agnostic now.
So. Yeah, yeah. I mean, because you can get to Pages and Numbers and Keynote beta, yep. Right?
Yeah, yep. It works really well now, though.
Cool. You know, I still hear people saying Apple doesn't know how to do cloud services. Apple sucks at cloud services. But I'm sorry. I think the Photos app is working spectacularly well, at least for me. And maybe I'm just really lucky. But I think they're getting the hang of it.
Well, they have such a history of messing those things up that I completely understand people not trusting them. The reality is Apple does not know how to make cloud services or web services until, you know, this one. They didn't until a year ago. So I completely understand people would be skeptical, but this one is spectacular. And when you look at the, the kind of apps that you can have as web apps now are pretty impressive. And Office, Microsoft Office versions, web versions are amazing. And the iWork suite on iCloud.com is spectacular as well. So
you know, I haven't played with it since you first did it, but yeah, I'm poking around here. You just keep talking. I'm going to play with iCloud. Oh, let's see. What else took you fancy in the big show?
Well, there are lots of things. I think the one thing that intrigued me, I think we could probably talk about the fact that they're focusing on having bug fixes and quality improvement of their OSs for this year's releases, you know, for both iOS and for macOS. This is why the features, even though we're very excited about some of them, they're not huge features. And I think it's a good thing. The fact that all the iOS 8 devices, iOS 8 capable devices, are going to be capable of running iOS 9. And hopefully some of them will even see some performance improvements. We're thinking about the, you know, iPhone 4S that is notoriously laggy with iOS 8. So that's really cool. I think it's very mature for Apple, and actually Google is doing the same thing this year, but to take a year almost off to polish their OSs a little bit. The yearly huge feature releases schedule is unsustainable if you want quality software, and it's good that they're realizing it. It's almost as if, you know, Tim Cook called up Sergey Brin and, you know, and they were like, hey, should we take a break this year?
Yeah,
you don't do anything major, us either. We'll just add features that are available in each other's OS. Yeah, let's do that. All right, let's do that.
While Microsoft is running around the fringes saying, hey, we'll make this work on your device. We'll make this work on your device. Yeah. Hey, we got all this stuff. And all of a sudden, we like Microsoft too. I mean, it's a funny world. I would love to think that that conversation actually took place. That delights me to think of that.
And with, you know, Microsoft bringing Windows 10 to life, which is honestly a phenomenal version of Windows as well, I think the ecosystems of you know, the software ecosystems are spectacular at this stage. But the other thing I could mention is one of the features from watchOS 2. I don't know if you've I know you use your watch quite a bit. I'm not a huge fan of my Apple Watch. Actually, okay. I don't really like it at all anymore.
we should talk about that.
Yeah.
What don't you like, or what makes it not compelling for you?
Or is it
just nothing compelling?
Yeah, basically, yeah. There's nothing. It's not that I hate it, to be honest. It's something that I don't find a use case. It doesn't fill a need for me. You know, the iPhone, when it came out, I felt like it was something I didn't quite realize I needed. But when I was shown what it could do, it was obvious that I needed it. And when I use it, it was even more obvious. But for the watch, I haven't found a use case that this actually fills for me. It's all of the things I'm doing on my watch are either not very useful or semi-frustrating because I could do them better on my phone, which I basically have on me almost all the time because, you know, I check Twitter every 2 minutes. And that's something I can't do on the watch. And so I have my phone with me. So if I'm going to have my phone with me anyway, there's no reason for me to look at the watch, I guess,
or to use the watch. I can't actually disagree with most of what you said or even say that my experiences are different. Opinion can't be wrong, right? I don't know.
I often think that opinions that aren't mine are wrong. But
Well, you're wrong about that. But when I got the iPhone, it was transformational fairly quickly, but I didn't think I needed one. It was just because it was there that I bought it. And then with the iPad, I was positive I didn't need it. I had no need whatsoever, and it became invaluable to me. I wouldn't call the watch invaluable. I'm really, really digging the exercise stuff. That's what's really gotten me excited. I exercise a lot already, but what I'm finding is I'm experimenting with different kinds of exercise because I'm getting metrics that tell me in the same length of time, would you like to burn 17% more calories, that kind of thing. And that really is motivational to me. And so the exercise stuff is a lot. I also wonder whether this is going to sound weird, but maybe it's more useful for women than men because it's a lot harder to dig your phone out of your purse than it is to pull out of your pocket. And we don't have pockets.
That's true, yeah.
And so I'm often in a situation where I just turn my wrist and see a text message that I care about, or more importantly, one I don't care about, and I can ignore it. That to me is huge. And not missing those notifications. That's the other thing.
I guess, yeah, the notifications I do use, obviously, when they come up, I look at the watch. But maybe I'm not such a notification nut that I need to know something immediately. I mean, I check my phone, as I was saying, I check it pretty often between my phone and my iPad. I probably have an eye on my notifications every half an hour at most. And I don't think there's anything in my life or in the world that cannot wait 30 minutes, right? Or an hour. And most likely it's not going to be an hour until I look at my phone. So in that sense, the watch doesn't provide that notification service to me.
I actually, I need to find a way to cut them back. One of the things that's important to me is a direct message, because that's usually somebody really wants to chat with me about something. So I have my Twitter messages set up, direct messages to send me a text message. So now I get a text message on my phone, on my both of my Macs, on my iPad, on my watch. And of course, I've got Twitter on all those things. And on the watch, I like to use Twitterific, because you can actually reply on the watch. But you can't get rid of Twitter, which means Twitter and Twitterific. I'm basically getting like 42 messages every single time I get a DM now. I've
had that problem as well. When I get a DM, I also get it by email.
I get email too.
Yeah. So, but I use Gmail, so I can't get push notifications anymore. So it comes delayed, by anything between 1 and 15 minutes. So it becomes a sort of weird chorus of the worst thing though is when I get an actual call, because with Continuum, everything rings. You know, you get the phone and the watch and the iPad and the Mac, and you're like, oh my God, what's happening?
What's nice is when they're delayed a little bit, so one starts ringing after you've already picked up, that kind of thing.
Yeah.
But I do have to say, today, my husband and I were eating lunch, and we were watching a video podcast on my iPad, and I had my watch on, and everything else was in another room, and my daughter called me back. And we answered the call on the iPad right while we were sitting there. So when you're not surrounded by all your devices, it's perfect. The problem is when you're surrounded by all your devices.
Yeah, I agree. There should be a thing where if you're using one of the device, then the other shouldn't ring, or at least as an option. But yeah, it happens to me very often, is actually, and it has happened with my watch that, you know, I would just answer on the watch and do the weird, you know, Inspector Gadget thing where you're talking to the watch. And if you want to say, hey, let me call you back in 5 minutes, it works. It's fine. Actually, we can talk about something that wasn't announced at the conference, which is the fact that this feature is going to start working even if your phone is in a different, you know, is somewhere else, not just on the same Wi-Fi network, but apparently T-Mobile is the first one of the U.S. providers that is going to enable you to have that functionality even if your phone is at home and you're, you know, somewhere else.
Some Wi-Fi somewhere?
Yep.
Really? So if you leave your phone at home, but you've got your watch, you could still get your phone calls and such?
Because the watch needs to be connected to the Wi-Fi as well. And the watch can't be connected to the Wi-Fi if your phone is not there. Although maybe in the future it could, but it's more for things like your Mac or your iPad. If your phone is at home, and I'm not even sure it needs to be connected to the Wi-Fi, it just needs to be, you know, connected to the cellular network. And your iPad is connected to the Wi-Fi, then your iPad would ring when your phone rings. That could be fun.
Wait. Oh, so I've got my. You're saying if I had my iPad with me, it would ring when my phone was at home, not my watch, because the watch doesn't have that. Oh, okay.
Because the watch needs to be connected to the phone anyway.
Yeah. Okay. That's kind of interesting.
Yeah. Although, you know, developers, apparently the watch is going to have, with watchOS 2, there's going to be a possibility for the watch to use Wi-Fi independently. So let's I don't know how you would connect the watch to a different Wi-Fi network, but maybe let's say your phone already has all of that information, how to connect to those Wi-Fi networks, and yeah. you've inputted the passwords. Your phone now knows all of that. Yeah, I'm sorry, your watch now knows all of this. So even if you're not close to your phone, it can connect to the Wi-Fi network and thus receive the data. I'm not quite sure it would work like that.
I assumed it was already doing that, because they say that if you're out of Bluetooth range but still on the same Wi-Fi network, that your phone and your watch can talk to each other.
So it must know.
Well, the thing
that it does, my understanding is the watch can communicate to the phone through the Wi-Fi network, mm-hmm. but it can't go get information from right. out on the internet through the Wi-Fi.
Right, but it has to know the Wi-Fi password.
Yes.
Right, so it's learned it from the phone. And I think that's the way a lot of these connected devices like the Wemo works. When you plug in a Wemo for the first time, you connect to the Wi-Fi network that the Wemo creates. And then so now your phone is talking to the Wemo, and then the Wemo holds onto the phone while the phone reaches over and grabs your Wi-Fi network, and that's how the Wemo learns, because you can't type right. the password into the Wemo. So I think it's that kind of a handoff sort of thing.
I'm guessing that's the way it would work now with the watchOS 2. In theory, I'm guessing it could work like this, and the watch would then learn all the Wi-Fi passwords you have. And if you're, you know, somewhere else, it would just connect directly to the internet, you know, with the Wi-Fi, even if the phone is not present. Right now, I don't think it can do that. It can connect to the Wi-Fi probably, but since it doesn't find the phone, it's saying, well, nothing I can do with this Wi-Fi network. I'm just, you know, whatever.
Just going to sit here.
My phone is not here. I'm just going to sit here and sulk.
I like the other stuff they're adding to the watch, though, that they're going to allow the third-party developers now start to talk to the watch, like get microphone access and access to the accelerometer, so you could write other kinds of health apps that were talking to the accelerometer.
Yeah, that would be cool. The thing that I like the most is the access to the complications, which are...
Isn't it funny how happy everybody is about that? It's like a 12-pixel by 12-pixel thing, and we're all a Twitter about it.
But, you know, if there's one thing that I actually enjoy on the watch, it's that. It's the fact that it can provide me with a very quick access to the information I want super easily. And I guess the thing I do use the most is the weather app. So I have the, as I think every geek on the planet, I have the very complication-heavy watch face.
Yeah.
And you do too, right?
Yeah. Is that modular, I think?
Yeah, something like that.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. I got like 12. If I could have 13 complications, I would.
Yeah, same thing. And so I have the weather. I have a couple of... time zone watches, because I work with the US a lot, and so for this, for example, how do they call it, time travel uh-huh. function is super cool, because so the way it works is that when you are on the watch face, you turn the digital crown, and it changes the time for on the watch. So it allows you to see basically what time it will be in whatever time you switch to. But it also changes all of the complications data to relate to that time you've selected. So now it's, you know, 11 in the evening. If I move the digital crown to 11:30, it will show the weather, you know, the temperature, it will be at 11:30, and, you know, and so on and so on. If you have a calendar complication, it will show the appointment you have at that specific time you've selected. And this is something that they've basically stolen from Pebble with the Pebble Time. It's the same kind of idea, but it's really cleverly implemented with the digital crown. And for me, things like time zone differences is going to be wonderful, because I finally have an easy way of knowing what time it is in 3 hours in whatever city. Super useful.
It doesn't tell you what day it is, though, does it, Patrick? Sorry, I just couldn't resist. That was mean. Yeah. You're never going to come back on the show if I keep teasing you.
It was entirely my fault that I thought Friday was Sunday, or the other way around.
I'm usually the one bad at this, so I actually feel a little bit better about that. By the way, I know a use for what are the things called? What is the thing called on the Mac where you can swipe to the right and you get the dashboard? Is that what it's called?
Yeah, is the dashboard still active at this point?
It is. You have to turn it on. Yeah. No, but there's a really good one. It's called Time Scroller, and it does exactly what you're talking about. It you put in what cities you want to watch. So, like, I watch Dublin because I talk to this guy Bart all the time in Dublin, and different cities. And I talk to people in New Zealand all the time. So you set up the cities you want. You can rename them with people's names, and then you can turn a dial basically to say, okay, if I ask him about 10 o'clock on Tuesday, 10 o'clock, what time will it be at his house? Huh. And it's free. It's really, really cool. it's the only reason to use the dashboard.
Yeah, I don't think I'm gonna enable dashboard for this.
Oh man, it's
but okay. They have an
iOS app too. Yeah, they do. Yeah, I think it's a buck or two. I've been using it forever, and I just love it. That one you can even say, like, you can select a group of people and say send an email about that time, and it shows everybody what time it is in their time zone.
All right, that's useful. Thank you.
You're welcome.
Will download it now for a couple of bucks.
There you go. That'll hold you over until your watch is more useful. You know, Andy Anako said something I thought was brilliant. He said he feels like the watch release was a soft launch for those of us that are nuts about this stuff, and the real release is when WatchOS 2 comes out.
Absolutely. I completely agree. This is, you know, this feels like even less of a full product than the iPhone was without the App Store.
Because we didn't know any better yet, right?
Yeah, exactly. But here, when you look at the features that WatchOS 2 are going to enable, it's fairly clear that these are essential things that give the watch a lot more usability. And, we'll see. Maybe I will like it more once WatchOS 2 is out. I really hope so. But, things like answering emails and having developers being able to access, to create native apps. We didn't even mention it because it's so obvious, right?
Yeah, yeah.
I wonder what it's going to do to the battery life. But it's so obvious you need that.
The battery life thing is interesting, and that is, too. The battery life, just about everybody is saying, man, I go to bed, it's at 40% every night. Well, I can tell you how to burn your battery down, and that's exercise a lot. My husband and I both work out a lot, and I run for like 40 minutes every morning, run or do the elliptical or whatever. And then in the afternoon, I do about an hour walk with my dog, and I want credit. Right. So I'm running the workout app to get credit. And that means the heart rate sensor's on for 2 hours a day. I burn out my battery on my watch almost every day.
Wow.
Burn it to the ground.
Hmm.
So I'm
guessing that's going to be a problem for you, because with native apps, I can't imagine it's going to use less battery.
Yeah. Yeah. Or maybe I get over this credit thing. Yeah, probably not. That's not gonna
It's okay. You know what? You're gonna be buying an Apple Watch 2 in a few months anyway.
There you go. That'll work. But the native apps is only going to be useful to me if they can fix how freaking slow it is to launch the apps they already have.
Well,
I tap on weather, and it's like a half an hour till it tells me. Not a half an hour.
I think that's the reason. No, but it's because it's not native. I think it's because it's retrieving the information from your phone, and that's why
it's
so slow.
Apple put it on there; it was native, but you're right; it doesn't have to be.
Yeah, I don't think it is. I don't think there are many native apps in the on the watch at the moment. There are a few things, probably, you know, the watch itself. I'm guessing the messages apps looks kind of native. I don't know,
it's pretty fast. Maps can't be native.
No,
maps
it's so slow.
It's horrible. So here's a thought, though. Could it save battery if you weren't having to talk Bluetooth between the phone and the watch the whole time?
Possibly. I mean, for things like maps, it's still going to have to retrieve the information through
the GPS on the phone.
Well, I'm guessing the Wi-Fi, the images, the map images are going to be retrieved from the web on through Wi-Fi, but maybe Wi-Fi is probably more battery demanding than Bluetooth. I don't
Bluetooth,
know.
It's Bluetooth LE, right? It's the low energy Bluetooth.
Yeah, you're right. Bluetooth LE, I think, is low energy when you're not using it. I don't know how much it uses, right? But that's the way it works, right?
Isn't everything energy when you're not using it?
But no, because the thing with Bluetooth LE is that it allows you to keep a device in standby. And it will be awoken if it receives data, but all that time it's in standby and doesn't get any data, you know, doesn't receive data, it consumes very little. Until Bluetooth LE, it would consume a lot even when it was just in standby. That it wouldn't have that super low energy mode.
Okay.
So I think that's...
I thought you were just being silly. You had a real reason behind that.
Yeah, exactly.
What did you think about Apple's very specific pronouncement about all of the data that you're putting into your device is yours and stays on your device, and they don't give it to anybody, sell it to anybody?
It's such a huge attack against Google. Obviously, you know, Google, and not even just Google, but it's the way they're differentiating. And obviously, you know, there are a bunch of things. They're adding the ability for people to create ad blockers on Safari, which is kind of a very surprising thing, but also... but yeah, it's basically the way they're differentiating. And then the thing is, there is value to quote-unquote free services that are paid for by ads, but the business of Apple is to sell you a very expensive device. And for that, because of that business model, they can afford to not use your data for anything nefarious you don't want them to use for. So I think it's good. It puts the emphasis on that issue that is a very real issue in our, you know, more and more now because of things like mass surveillance and those kinds of issues. And I think it's good that we have one actor whose thing is we keep your data private. It's an alternative for people who want that. It puts a little bit of pressure on the others to not go too far. I still think that, you know, I live in the Google ecosystem for services, so I think there's a huge value to services that are free and paid for by advertisement, but I'm very happy that one company is saying that's not the way we work, and our value is somewhere else. Our value is selling you a watch for $1,000.
Yeah, I thought about this a lot in the in all the rabid comparisons going on right now with Apple Photos versus Google Photos. And I've been giving my friends over on the SMR podcast a hard time because they were saying that the Google Photos was far and away better, and I don't think so. But when you look at one terms of service that says, yeah, and we can sell your photos, use them for advertising, pretty much anything we want, wallpaper, side of a building.
No, they don't say that. They don't say that.
Yeah, they do. Well, they don't say the wallpaper, the building part, but I'm pretty sure they said they can use them for third-party stuff.
But these kinds of things are usually because if you want to have other, you know, apps and things like that access your photos, they have to allow those services to access them. It's not that they're going to start selling your photos and, you know, making money on the pictures you've taken, and that is not how it works.
I should double check that sell it part.
Okay, we get double check.
Let's see. I'll keep looking while I talk at the same time.
Okay.
But on the other hand, those same people that worry about that will often complain that, well, Apple's ridiculous that they're charging such high fees to have your photos online. And I don't know. I'm paying for one of the most expensive plans, the 500 gigabytes for $100 a year. And it's sort of like, well, $100 a year or you control my photos. That doesn't sound that bad when you put
okay,
it that way.
But let me ask you this. Do you use Facebook?
Yeah, and I post publicly too, not just to my friends.
Well, there you go.
Well, but I'm also not complaining about it. I'm just speaking of it as other people are saying, you know, do you really want to do that? I am uploading all my photos to Google Photos. In fact, I should have paused that before I started. and just so that I can understand it, you know.
Yeah, no, I think, you know, it's important that people understand what are the different elements of each service. And certainly the loss of control over your data is probably a lot higher if you entrust your data with a service like Google than if you do with a company like Apple, simply because of the business model. And it doesn't mean that one is necessarily better or more adapted to one specific person than the other, but it's important that people understand what this is, you know. With Apple, you're going to be paying probably more money for a device that is, you know, more or less arguably similarly featured, or we can debate on the preferences, but I think at this point it's more personal preferences. But you know that they're not making money selling ads against your data, and that's a very important thing for some people. So.
Yeah, I think the point you made was very well taken, that you can have a choice now. Or you have been able to have a choice for a while, but that you have this choice of whether to pay to have things as private as you want or to get free stuff. And I think it's a good discussion to have so people understand why you're getting it for free, right? It's not just for free. It's free because you're paying for it with privacy.
Yeah, it's very well put phrase that if the product is free, then you are the product. You know, it's very telling. If the thing you're using is free, it's probably because they're making money on you, on your data. So,
yeah. I'm just going to use everything, and what am I going to do?
Yeah, exactly. That's ultimately what everyone ends up doing. But at least we know everything that it implies.
Yeah.
What about Apple Music?
Well, a not so secret fact about me is that I don't listen to any music at all. I believe I have a syndrome they've identified called music specific anhedonia. I am completely apathetic about music. So I went and made lunch during the music part, but now I've listened to people try to describe it, and for the life of me, I don't know what they announced. And that seems to be a prevalent viewpoint.
I think it's a hodgepodge of lots of things that could be, each one of them could be somewhat cool, and the potential for having something really cool for music lovers is there, but we don't know if any of those different things is going to stick. But the main thing is, they're getting into the music streaming business because the music selling business is declining. They're not getting out of that, but they're adding a music streaming portion. That's pretty straightforward, and it's comparable to the other services that were doing this before Apple. The thing is, it seems you're going to have access to all of the iTunes catalog. That's what they implied, and the iTunes catalog has some artists that the others don't have, things like AC/DC, the Beatles, Taylor Swift.
I heard the Beatles were not going to be in the streaming piece, though.
Ah, it's possible. Well, they didn't advertise that fact.
Okay. Let's make a big announcement later when they do.
Well, I don't think they're ever going to make a big announcement that we don't have the Beatles. So, but yeah, I'm sure this will come
up. So what is the streaming service called?
Oh, it's just Apple Music.
Apple Music. Okay, yeah. So that's number one. There's Apple Music, and that's the streaming thing.
Well, you know, Apple Music is the entire thing. It includes an entire ecosystem where you can stream music. You can listen to that Beats Radio station.
Yes, yeah, so what is that?
So that's basically a radio station going on 24 hours a day, and it's just actual DJs selecting music that people are probably interested in discovering. So it's ridiculous because it's the oldest thing in broadcasted music, right? And no one has done it before. And that's kind of silly. I guess, you know, there have been music radio stations on the web here and there, but none of the music-focused services have created a radio channel. And
so you think it has value?
Yeah, I think so. I think anything, you know, the problem with music, now that we can listen to anything we want, the problem is discovery.
Right.
It's very difficult for a music enthusiast to discover new music because you automatically go back to what you already know, you already enjoy. And even though, you know, there are what is essentially lots of stores where you can go to, you know, virtually, you go to Spotify or YouTube or whatever, and you can, you could go and listen to anything that's offered to you there or to the top 100. I think a lot of people that aren't music nuts don't do it. And so there is a real value to going somewhere where someone, a human being, is going to tell you, why don't you listen to this? And, you know, maybe you're going to like that. So there's going to be that with the radio station.
But a single station seems funny,
right? So that's a good question. I don't think it's going to be just one.
Oh, okay. Okay, it's starting.
They have one, which is the main one. But I doubt it's going to be just one, because that.
Because I mean, what if I don't? What if it's hip hop all day long and I don't like hip hop? But then it wouldn't exist, right? It's got to be more than one. You know, even though I don't listen to music, I think I can resonate to this. One of my problems with going to reading all my books on the Kindle is that I have no discovery anymore, because people used to hand me books.
Right.
You know, the friend at the gym just goes, oh my God, you got to read this, and hands me a book. Oh, well, all right, I'll read a book. Now, I'm paying them a lot more money, so they should be happy about that now. But I don't, I have to call people up and go, okay, give me a book. What should I read?
Yeah. And it's, you know, the irony is that you have access to all the books in the world. And still,
so I can't find any.
You know, you need that, and you know, that's, it's really interesting. It's behaviors that we're discovering for ourselves as a human race, struggling to find out how we work when technology gets involved in that way. And things for books or music, it would make sense that when you have access to anything at your fingertips, it enriches your. Music or literary or whatever it is, background. But the reality is, apparently it doesn't, for some weird psychological reason.
Right.
So that discovery problem, no one has really managed to solve. We've had playlists and rankings, and all of those have already existed in all of the music apps we have. But it doesn't work in a satisfactory manner.
Uh-huh.
So the option of having a radio station and the For You tab, which gives you selections that are created through algorithms and curators. So we don't know how exactly it's going to work, but it's going to be things that are a little bit more personalized with a little bit more of a human touch, which is what Beats was doing already with their online service. So between all of those,
so that's
hopefully
the third
they
thing
managed
is the
to...
For You thing? Because I knew there were three. There's the streaming, there's the radio station, and then there's the For You. Or is the For You part of the streaming?
No, the For You is not part of the streaming. There's sort of five little icons at the bottom of the app. And there are, you know... Honestly, it's a little bit confusing still. I think we have to wait until June 30th to see what it is exactly. But For You is one. What song comes next is a big question, and I think they're trying to solve that question. They insisted on this quite a bit, because you know what you're listening to, but you're not sure what you want to listen next. And that's one of the things they're trying to solve with that For You and music and radio and new music as well. So, and they have a Connect part, which is kind of a Instagram for music. You know, Instagram is Twitter for pictures, and everything started becoming Instagram for something else. And we have Instagram for lots of things, but it's kind of mind-boggling that we don't have an Instagram for music. There is no easy way for me to go, you know, maybe listen to things that friends are listening to, and then, or even just me listen to something and share it with the world through an app that will then copy it to Instagram and Facebook. And then when people click on that link, they are able to listen to that piece of music.
Okay. I've heard a lot about you can share playlists and things like that, but apparently that's it's not smooth enough.
So I don't think the problem is the beauty of Instagram. Well, the beauty, the principle, the idea behind Instagram, is that you click on the link and you see the picture, right? So you could be sharing anything. And even if you're coming from Twitter or Facebook or wherever, You're going to click on the thing and see what the person wants you to see. There's no such thing with music. Either, you know, if you're subscribed to Spotify, for example, you might be using a specific type of... there's one app called Sound Tracking, which I use, which can kind of do that, but not really. And so I can't post a link, and I can't easily post a link on Twitter that someone will click and listen to what I want them to listen to.
Okay. Okay.
I could hodgepodge it through YouTube maybe, and maybe the another, you know, it's complicated. And hopefully this makes it simple. So that could work. And then the pricing is kind of okay, but it's, you know, $10 per month.
The family share thing was a really good price,
yes.
Right?
For that is where they're doing. It's $15 for six people. So that's
and six
that's,
people whose music is not mashed together.
No. Everyone has access to their own thing. It's like
that's magic.
Yeah, it's really the big. A hitting pricing thing. We've heard they wanted to have a $5 or $7 subscription, but the music industry didn't want to. But that $15 a month is for six people. Currently, I have Spotify, and my wife does too. Actually, I don't even think we did it, but you're supposed to be, you can link the accounts and pay $15 for two accounts. Here, it's for six, and that's pretty big. And they're launching the app on Android as well by the end of the year.
That'll be good.
That is huge. It's really big.
I pride myself on having no music on my iPhone, but there was a bug for a while. It seems to have settled out, where on the iPhone, if I was listening to a podcast in the car and I got out of the car and I got back in, instead of starting up at the podcast, it would play the first song in my music library. And my son had purposely put one of his horrible heavy metal brain wrecking songs on my phone. So I'd get in my car and I'll say, dun, 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 dun. It was horrible. He thought it was hilarious, though.
I think it's hilarious. Please compliment him for me.
I ended up putting another song in there. So at least like every other time, I think it switched between them. I will. Well, hey, I promised to only keep you for 45 minutes, and I've kept you a lot longer than that. Do you feel that you were able to get enough out of your system to hold you over now?
Listen, I feel so much better. Thank you so much. Now, you know, I've talked it out, and I'm very satisfied.
Oh, that's great. That's great. Well, I hope we get to be on DTNS together sometime. What day of the week are you on the Daily Tech News Show?
I'm on Tuesdays.
Great, great. And where else can people find you to follow what you do?
Well, you can follow me on Twitter. I'm not Patrick on Twitter. It's very easy to remember. It's Patrick, except with not in front of it. And I'm on FrenchSpin.com. I do a couple of shows in English. I'm actually French, so most of my shows are in French, but two of my shows are in English. One of them is about gaming. It's a show called Pixels, and the next one is going to be pretty interesting because we have the big E3 conference coming up, and we're going to do a special this week about all of the big announcements at E3. And the other one is called The Phileas Club, and on that one, I invite people from different countries around the world every month, and we discuss the news and each person will try to give you the way they saw the news from their country and culture. Every month. So you'll have people from, you know, the Middle East and Asia and Scandinavia and Europe and the US, and we confront all of those visions, and it's usually a lot of fun. We actually have a lot of fun on the show. It's not too serious, but it's also very interesting.
Oh, so, yeah, that sounds fascinating, because I've heard we don't look at everything the same.
That is indeed something I've heard, and I'm trying to see if it's the case.
All right, Patrick, thank you so much for being on and juggling your schedule and the time zones and everything, because I know you're in Finland right now. Is that right, or Norway?
No, I'm in Finland. I'm in Finland. And, you know, it's what time is it now? It's 15 past 11, and it's still super broad daylight outside.
Oh, so I didn't even make you feel like you're up that late.
No, it's perfect.
All right. Thanks again, Patrick.
Thank you so much.
Oh, man, did I have a good time with Patrick. That was just perfect. That was just like, I had this huge grin on my face the whole time I was recording you. I'm sure you could hear it in my voice. I just love talking to that guy. So I'm looking forward to having him back. I didn't ask him if he wanted to come back, but we'll find out. Well, that's going to wind us up for this week. Many thanks to our sponsor for helping pay the bills. You can be as cool as me getting called out by Dave Hamilton as having a killer tutorial if you go to clarify-it.com. Don't forget to send in your dumb questions. Steve Davidson has a really, really good one. I love this question because it was really, really hard to solve. So he solved it himself, but he made it a dumb question. But he's the one who's going to answer it. And he's going to record it this week. And hopefully that will be for next week. So keep bringing those dumb questions on. You can send those to me by emailing me at allison@podfeet.com, and I'm on Twitter at Podfeet. Do go over to the NoSillaCast Google Plus community. It's at podfeet.com/Google+. I use this as a big resource. Right now, I'm trying to get rid of an old Mac, and I was going to sell it, but then it occurred to me that what if I could give it to my housekeeper's son? Kid's about, 10 or 12 years old, and he's got nothing to do this summer. And I was thinking, what if I could have him take some computer classes while he's going to come to my house once a week? What if I could have him take some programming classes or something, and I could set a goal for him that if he did these classes, I'd give him the computer at the end of the summer? I think he'd really like it, and he's a smart kid. You know, he can do this. So I don't know what computer classes I should have him take. So I posted the question over on podfeet.com/Google+, and I've got a bunch of people answering me. I'm letting it roll for a while. I'm going to see what people come up with. Anyway, if you've got questions that you know I'm too dumb to answer, which does absolutely happen, please go over to the Google Plus community. It's a great place to post. If you want to join in the fun of the live show, don't forget, it's at podfeet.com/live every week, but next week it is on Tuesday at noon Pacific time. You can go there and join the friendly and enthusiastic NoSilla Castaways. Thanks for listening and stay subscribed.